This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today is our ethics series, mini-series, where, you know, in this mini-series, we've been discussing various areas related to bioethics. You know, we've looked at the basic of what ethics means in healthcare. We've looked at how it plays out in research, how it's important in clinical practice. And today we want to look at the ethics of caring for vulnerable populations. And you know, for everyone really, all of us, when we are in need of health services, we are often at our most vulnerable. You know, we are unwell, we're feeling a little afraid, we are uncertain. Now, imagine if you're from a marginalized community, you know, such as refugees, migrants, or ethnic minority groups. And what happens when they face discrimination at the point of care? What is the impact of this on their well-being? What does it say about us as a society? And, you know, we want to also explore how do we ensure that ethics within the healthcare profession is not replaced by prejudice? So joining me to help me break down these ethical issues are Dr. Sushila Balasundaram, Associate Public Health Officer with UNHCR, which is the UN Refugee Agency, as well as Dr. Tan Hui Siu, Head of Hospital Ethics Support Service at Hospital Ampang. She's also the co-founder of the Malaysian Bioethics Community. You know, maybe we can start with a look at what vulnerable communities actually go through, what kinds of experiences they face when they seek healthcare, when it comes to, you know, being discriminated against, negative experiences, perhaps, you know, to really be able to step into their shoes and see what they experience. Maybe we can start with you, Dr. Sushila. Really, I know from your work over the years with refugees, I'm sure there's a lot you can share in terms of what the refugee communities go through.
I think in general, I think there's still a lot of fear, and for many of our refugees when they access healthcare, mainly because also communication in terms of their difficulty in communicating what they need, and to be able to have the language, you know, advantage to explain and to communicate properly with people at the counters. And so many of them in general, you know, face a lot of difficulty, in particular with communication. But also, of course, the affordability of healthcare is a big barrier for them. There has been an increase in foreigners' rates since 2016. And even though refugees with, who are registered with UNHCR have discount of 50% off the foreigners' rate, this is just still a lot of money for them to pay. For example, a deposit to go into the hospital will still cost them about 1,400 ringgit. Hence, many a time, you know, they are facing a lot of difficulties at the point of admission, you know, dealing with counters who tell them that, you know, you can't get admitted because you're not able to pay. And so a lot of these problems, and also because of their lack of understanding also and the lack of ability to communicate, many a times they are not able to understand what exactly happens at the point of procedures. And so that's, in a nutshell, the kind of challenges they face on a daily basis.
Dr. Sushila, you said you started off by saying fear. Why is there fear?
Yeah, I think in our public health systems, there still exists this circular that necessitates staff at the hospital to arrest people who are undocumented. So not just speaking for the refugees per se, because they do carry documents if they're registered with us, but many who are undocumented asylum seekers, as well as undocumented migrants, or even stateless people who do not have any documents, they can be reported to the immigration. And hence, you know, immigration procedures come in whereby they can be detained. Hence, previous instances of such happenings have already, you know, instilled a lot of fear in persons who may step in without a document.
Dr. Tan, from that healthcare provider's perspective, what do you observe?
Okay, so I've been in the public health system for the past maybe 17 years. And I think when we talk about vulnerable groups, definitely we have, you know, patients that are poor, you know, we have children, you know, the ones which are feel, you know, the ones with the mental health issues. And, you know, so I think the refugees, migrant population, like what Dr. Sushila has mentioned about that social cultural barrier, is actually one of the most important aspect that we look into, because it includes a lot of, like, not only knowing when to come, knowing, you know, how to actually kind of tell what are the medical problems they're having, you know, also on the other end, you know, the healthcare providers, we need to actually understand, you know, what are their, you know, health beliefs. You know, we have had, you know, parents or, you know, even patients who had a different kind of thoughts about, like, what is considered, you know, healthy, you know, what is considered as things that would make them feel better. So I think it is a very, it's not easy to actually kind of cross over sometimes to even provide care. So many healthcare professionals, I would say over the board, I think the constraint for us to actually kind of to provide the care that we think we are obligated to provide, you know, and I think that causes a lot of distress, actually, that we are being constrained by, you know, it is more of a systemic and structural kind of constraints that are there that we can't cross over, you know, in terms of the financing part as well, in terms of healthcare, you know, and also I think in terms of providing primary care, which is, I think it's the most important basic health needs for any population to begin with, like maternal child health. And that is one thing that I think even the Ministry of Health, I know that have been trying to lobby for getting back free immunization, antenatal care, you know, and I think that is something that, you know, health professionals and health care systems in the public is actually working very hard, because there's a difference between, you know, what you're looking at, you know, the people's view, what are the central government is trying to, you know, allocate their resources, or and also the other end, which is the professionals, you know. So the challenges are still there. I think the best way is actually to know how to navigate through these barriers and knowing where to seek for help. So in the hospital, even in Ampang now, we kind of know where to seek for some of the alternative funds and clinics that could help with our patients. And so we have collaboration with, you know, like the Qatar Clinic or even the Clinic Amar Muhajir, that we kind of try and see whether how much they could help us with some of our patients.
All right. I do appreciate that you are also sharing the constraints as providers, right, as healthcare workers, you know, what you are limited by and how you try to navigate that as well. Dr. Sushila, is that something that has become a practice perhaps for UNHCR and other refugee support groups to help individual persons try and navigate, right? If you can't afford, we'll try and get funding here and there. You know, what is that landscape looking like?
Yes, I think that is an ongoing effort all the time because of our limited resources also. I mean, we do have a budget and we are working together currently with Imaret as our implementing partner in delivering medical assistance. Previously, that's always been done directly from UNHCR, but we needed to move to a partner this time. And Imaret also has, you know, the QFFD clinic that they're running. So they're very much in touch with the communities. So we work closely with them in reaching out to support those who need funds to go to hospital, but also to with a lot of other groups like the Refugee Emergency Fund, the Tiny Gold Hearts Foundation. You know, there are many cases that needs like huge amounts of money, and so we try to see, you know, those that fall within what we can support and those what we can't support, whether we can then also look to others to cost share. And Zuchi Foundation also has been, you know, a key player in providing that support as well. So that is an ongoing thing that we have.
But that can't be a sustainable solution, right? Considering the huge numbers
exactly,
of refugees.
Yeah. So previously, we've also started the insurance program. You know, we had worked with the private healthcare insurance companies to do so. However, because of the increase in prices in 2016, that made a huge dent in terms of the claims. And at that time also, the asylum seekers did not have the 50% discount. In 2018, when we met with the Ministry of Health then, We managed to get a discount for the asylum seekers as well. So that kind of reduced a little bit the claim rate for the insurance, but still, it was too little too late, and it was too unprofitable for the private companies to continue. And I think lessons learned from that is that we need full on the engagement of the Ministry of Health in or the government of Malaysia to actually look at a proper health financing scheme that includes refugees, very much modeled like what we have for the foreign workers, which is the SPICPAR. And with that, I think, you know, refugees can also contribute to their own healthcare, because even when we were running refugee medical insurance, we found that, you know, 60% of the contributions were coming from refugees who were just doing, you know, odd jobs, you know, and not even having access to formal work rights. You know, they were able to contribute to themselves and not be a burden to taxpayers. So I think that is still the way to go. And we do have a good example in Thailand, where they have universal healthcare coverage and they provide access to insurance scheme even for the undocumented migrants. So access to primary care, screening tests, as well as to secondary healthcare, even including HIV treatment.
You know, Dr. Sushila, you mentioned the challenges are very much systemic in nature. You know, language barriers, the cost of paying for the services. But have refugees and, you know, if you are aware of other vulnerable communities, faced outright discrimination due to personal prejudices from the healthcare professions?
Yeah, there are some instances, even including, you know, these are more exceptions, I would say, including actually reporting them, because this was within the circular that they need to be reported to the authorities. And so we've had instances where they've been treated quite, you know, with much hostility because they can't pay and they're threatened to not to be admitted, even in a very difficult stage. And there has been instances because of that, you know, they are not able to get access. I've seen, you know, really cases that have been quite neglected in a way because they have not been able to get access. I guess overall, I think that the larger issue is more systemic and more institution enabling environments that, and probably a leadership that needs to be a little bit more compassionate in the healthcare system in leading this, because I think healthcare providers are trying to do as much as they can. As much as there are instances of hostility, there's also the instances of doctors who put together money to try to help them get care. By and large, I think the healthcare providers are trying to do their best within the limitations of the system. Mm-hmm. And they reach out to us and, you know, ask us like, what else can we do? You know, trying to, you know, go around the system, as what Dr. Tan was alluding to. And so I think there needs to be that systemic change, I think, to have systems in place that allows for people to contribute to their own healthcare, so it doesn't feel like, you know, they're a burden to the taxpayers. Then we can look at other things like, you know, a more appropriate and acceptable kind of atmosphere in terms of, you know, having people who speak the language, you know, support from translation for translation. So then we also can look at, you know, the other things like, you know, educating communities on how to seek healthcare and what they need to do themselves in their own agency as well.
Yeah. Dr. Tan, would you like to add to that?
I think the one thing that we are trying to promote at all levels, even in the society, because I think that there is much also in terms of like what you have said about prejudices, whether it actually comes from the professionals or whether it is because they are part of the citizens, you know, of this Malaysia. So that there is two parts of them, you know, that when they see another person, you know, but whether they feel that they have the right to the same, you know, kind of opportunities or social goods. And I think that is where we need to go at many levels to actually kind of promote that, you know, we work with constraints, you know, but then are we a compassionate society, you know, and we'll say that, you know, if they come to us, and we should at least create the safe spaces for them. And, you know, to be as best as we could to actually respect the person in front of you, you know, as a human, you know. And I think that is a very difficult thing to do, because I think every one of us has a bit of biases and prejudices. And sometimes we call it an implicit bias that you you didn't know that, you know, you actually have some different kind of thoughts about or stereotyping another person of a different social cultural background. And I think the one way to actually put yourself into is actually always to ask, you know, and always have that cultural humility and saying, you know, what, where, who are you, you know, what are you, what do you believe in? And I think that personalized approach that we could actually kind of try and inculcate among the professionals, I think something that we are lacking a lot, I would say, that this cultural competency and humility training in our med school and, you know, in the professional group. And I think that is very much lacking, because that's how I think we need to look into how to kind of balance that power between groups as well, because we're always the doctors, and even a patient, you know, coming into the room, sometimes we fail to recognize that there is that power that imbalances there, you know, apart from all the, you know, cultural differences that we have. Mm-hmm. So I think that is one thing I would say that is very much lacking. I'm not sure whether that is the reason that has played into the impression that they are being discriminated, and you know, the way that we are perceiving that, you know, that there is some form of biases or prejudices, that which is not only at the structural and systemic level, but also, like what you said, the behaviors. Mm-hmm. And also the processes as well. You know, there's a lot of processes that we take it for granted, you know, that it has caused quite a bit of burdens to, you know.
Yeah, the processes are difficult even for an average person to navigate, right? So many layers. Like I said earlier, when you're unwell and you're seeking healthcare, you're already vulnerable. So if you have additional challenges like not being able to communicate, that fear and all that, I can't imagine how much more difficult it must be. But let's go for a quick break. And when we come back, I want to try and understand what is the impact in terms of health. This is, after all, the Health and Living Show. So while we talk about these kinds of institutional barriers that create hurdles for vulnerable populations when they are at the point of care, what is the impact on their health status? What is the impact on public health as well, the health of our entire population? So I'm speaking today to Dr. Tan Hui Siu, Head of Hospital Ethics Support Service at Hospital Ampang, and she's also the co-founder of the Malaysian Bioethics Community, as well as Dr. Sushila Balasundram, Associate Public Health Officer at UNHCR. We're discussing the ethics of caring for vulnerable populations such as refugees and migrants. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao Ik. My guests today are Dr. Sushila Balasundram, Associate Public Health Officer at UNHCR, and Dr. Tan Hui Siu, Head of Hospital Ethics Support Service at Hospital Ampang, and also the co-founder of the Malaysian Bioethics Community. This is the fourth part of our ethics mini-series, and today we are looking at the ethics of providing healthcare for vulnerable populations. Today the spotlight is somewhat more on a refugees, on migrant workers, the challenges that they face when they're seeking healthcare. Many of these are institutional barriers, you know. They come in with language barriers already, not being able to communicate with the healthcare worker in front of them. There's fear as well due to the circular that requires Ministry of Health staff to report those who are undocumented. So this affects undocumented migrant workers, undocumented asylum seekers, as well as those who are stateless. The cost barrier is enormous, something that maybe some of us as Malaysians, we take for granted. But it is a huge challenge for someone who is affected by the foreigners, you know, fee structure in the healthcare system. Now, can we look at the impact on individuals, on families, and on the entire community when they are not able to seek the same level of healthcare that the rest of us enjoy quite freely? Dr. Sushila, maybe I can start with you.
I guess the lack of access would also end the fear, you know, and hence people tend to delay healthcare to the last moment. So they go into unnecessary complications that could have been avoided if they were able to seek healthcare early. And hence, you know, the cost actually is even more after that, not just to themselves in terms of disability and, you know, the long-term consequences, and not just for the patient, but for the family. If the person is a breadwinner, you know, they go into further depravity of their already, you know, poor conditions. It's relevant to also mention at this time of the pandemic, the public health consequences of such lack of access or fear of access. So when it comes to infectious disease, I think we want to remove all barriers as much as possible so that people come forward and seek care early and not to be fearful, because of course the spread among the community is more. I think people tend to, you know, also discriminate and stigmatize foreigners in that, you know, they bring infectious disease, but it is that they are living in vulnerable conditions. They are not able to afford healthcare as much as we are able to, and hence, you know, they are in a place where they are vulnerable to disease transmission. Hence, not that they're carrying disease, but they are more likely to contract disease and spread easily because they live in difficult circumstances, overcrowded conditions. And I think it's also good to point out that it's not just for non-citizens, but also for urban poor Malaysians who are living in the same kind of conditions. And they are just as vulnerable. Yeah.
Dr. Tan, how has this affected healthcare providers? You know, as Dr. Sushila said, you have to see these patients when they are at the worst end of the spectrum already.
Okay, so I think it is important to actually know there's a difference between health and healthcare. And I think in terms of health, you know, there is definitely so much layers to what we call the social determinants to health. So I think to say that whether, you know, healthcare itself is only just one part of like health determinants, you know, to ensure that a person has a good health outcome in terms of life expectancy, you know, that they could enjoy the activities, you know, they are free from disability. So I think there is many more aspects that fit into health. And not just healthcare, which is like when you are sick that you go to the hospital and you're sick for tertiary care. And I think there is a difference between, you know, when you don't have the accessibility to healthcare. Okay, definitely it will impact if you are coming in late, you know, you have a complicated disease and you can't afford to treat or, you know, pay for a surgery. You know, I think in that sense, it will definitely kind of impact your health or your life at a very significant way. But definitely there is a lot more that we are looking at that in terms of, again, primary care and, you know, preventive medicine, that I think that is the part that we are looking at without receiving what are the impact to the vulnerable populations. I think that basic health needs are equally not there. And so that's why I think, and there are many, many more, you know, I think aspects that it goes into health impacts in terms of like educational level, you know, and what do they eat, you know, whether they have healthier options, you know, in terms of food, you know, clean water, you know. So I think that there is a lot other social determinants that it actually plays into health itself. So I think healthcare, when we say that we are not able to provide as what we wanted to, it impacts to a certain level. But there are many, many other aspects that we need to always remember. In terms of pandemic, I think it is something that we are struggling as well as healthcare providers now, because
Absolutely.
There are so many lives lost. So many became sick and continue to be sick. And I think the social impact to families, economy and livelihood is just like, we just can't describe this. It's so challenging at this point of time. So when there are many instances where there are tense moments where even the Malaysian population, like Dr. Sushila saying that, you know, blaming the migrants for the outbreaks, or, you know, even the deteriorating state of the citizens' social, economic and livelihood, like, you know, that emotions were so high. So it is partly not only the immigration department is trying to clamp on immigrants at the wrong timing, but also the Malaysians' emotions, you know, at that point of time. And I think those are the two things that has caused so much of strain in terms of getting the refugees and migrants to actually come forward to be tested and, you know, being treated. And I think that would be the greatest challenge in terms of public health responses and measures. I'm not a public health officer, but we know that in terms of public health, the strategies has been more of a targeted one and also more of like going where the public health interests are. So I think for migrants and refugees and anybody, at this point of time, all the fees are waived. So you don't have to pay if you have COVID and, you know, we all interconnected, like, you know. So I think we should have that shared responsibilities and also the shared, we call it intentionality. Because I think Malaysians fail to see that when it comes to COVID pandemic, we are at the receiving end of good deeds also from other countries, you know, from receiving vaccinations, you know, it's not something that we have developed ourselves. So I think the global effort and, you know, trying to overcome the pandemic, you know, it needs to have that solidarity there. And also we call it a shared intentionality that we need to actually work together. Well, we are a global community as well. And I think there's no way that we are safe and the other is not safe yet. And we are going to be, we can't get out of it without getting everybody out of it.
So just to reiterate, COVID testing and COVID treatment is free for anyone in a public hospital or a clinic, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is that the case for vaccinations as well?
Yes. Yeah. Of course, the Minister of Mosti, YB Khairi, then had already announced that all non-citizens, whether documented or undocumented, will be able to access the vaccinations. I think the big challenge is really getting on MySejahtera, which is also a problem for many Malaysians, I believe. Mm-hmm. For many sections of our population, I guess, getting on the app and tech savviness, as well as having the relevant phones to be able to access this app, has been the challenge. Yes, by and large, that is a great move. You know, we had been also, I think a lot of people have been advocating, and we are glad that the government saw that and had moved towards that. And as probably to also emphasize and reiterate what Dr. Tan said, we are all interconnected, you know, and people need to realize that before they start pointing fingers as to who's starting a cluster and who's not. If you don't treat or provide vaccinations to this other person who's also contributing to this economy, then, you know, you never know when it comes back to affecting your own family members. That is how you can never trace that linkage, right? So I think people need to change their mindsets a little bit. I think move away from that sort of xenophobic drive that's been going on in many sectors of social media as well, and move towards a more inclusive and a compassionate approach in how we are looking at this whole pandemic.
Yeah, I think where I get stuck is how. How do we move there? Whether it's at the leadership level, at the community, societal level, at the healthcare providers level, these are values that you can't you can't force onto people. You can't pay lip service to it. So I'd like to get your thoughts as well. You know, we are here in this to talk about this in the context of ethics. Then, so would putting an ethical lens on it perhaps change the practices and start to change policies in the institutions and the systems? Dr. Tan, perhaps your thoughts first.
Okay, that's a big question, right? I think the legal kind of protection or even enabling from the legal aspects of, like, you know, in terms of rights and what might not be there. But I think ethically, I think not only like what we have said about like human to human, and also at the societal level, it would be the social contract that, you know, kind of whether what we owe to each other and that kind of discussions could be formed at a public discourse. It could be in the public sector, in the private sector, or even the civil societies, you know, that we say how much should everyone contribute, equally contribute and receive, you know, social goods and protection. You know, so meaning it's you need to contribute, and if you are contributing, how much, you know, you deserve to receive, you know, the opportunities in terms of like, you know, food, employment, and school, and you know, I think that would be at a very highest level of, we would say, an ethical workings, and you know, then I think if we have reached that maturity of a mature society, then I think there is way forward in terms of not waiting for a legal protection or waiting for the government of the day to actually do something about vulnerable groups.
Dr. Sushila, your thoughts? I mean, from UNHCR's perspective, will anything really change if Malaysia doesn't ratify the Convention for the Rights of Refugees?
Yeah, I think it's not just about, it doesn't boil down to just ratifying rights, the convention actually. I think the government can certainly decide on domestic legal framework to manage refugees, and within that have a healthcare policy for refugees, which could include, like, for example, you know, the financing scheme I mentioned, and within the financing scheme have elements included that will address all public health concerns, for example, screening for particular diseases, you know, have that incorporated within the insurance scheme, have vaccinations included for children within the insurance scheme. So there are ways to go about it without having to go straight for the ratifying the convention. And I think there are countries like, for example, India that has not ratified convention but yet provide access to healthcare and education for refugees. So that's not necessarily something that Malaysia needs to do, but at least have a proper policy to manage refugees domestically. I think that's all we need.
All right. Dr. Tan, I'd like to get to that point you made earlier about cultural competency and humility training. I find that so interesting. And if we can talk a little bit about that, you know, is that something that comes in as a structured form of training? How would that counter, say, the kinds of behaviors, prejudices and cultural norms that we've been discussing?
Okay, so this part of social culture and, you know, competency and, you know, humility and implicit biases and prejudices falls under kind of a branch of bioethics, which is quite interesting, which is the feminist ethics. So I think that is where, you know, feminist ethics actually, you know, they are trying to rethink and reformulate, you know, the traditional ethics and to focus on identities, perspective, lenses, you know, of especially the marginalized or oppressed group. And also it focused a lot on these power differences and, you know, demand that all voices are included. And from there, I think we would work into more of like trying to look at the perspective and identity of a person, you know, even with your social cultural backgrounds, you know, the faith that you were holding and you know, the educational level or your family's influence, everything. But every person has a different way of looking at things or, you know, making decisions. And I think that safe space, personal or individual safe space, must be there for every patient that comes into the hospital, you know, that should be protected. So I think the cultural competency at the moment, I don't see much of, we would say, training. Maybe at this point of medical education, you know, in the university, I think they would be touching a little bit on that. I think interprofessional kind of education, meaning in the hospitals, you know, I don't see that happening yet. Of course, I think the wishful thing is to have a cultural department in all healthcare facilities, you know, and having caseworkers, you know, you have translators and that managers that could work on all these barriers, you know, languages and, you know, financial, legal issues, you know, for vulnerable groups, which is not there. I would say it's something that we should work towards, and not only for vulnerable groups, but even for, you know, a multicultural society like Malaysia.
Mm. Yeah. So the cultural competency training, you know, you say that's probably only done at a very small level in medical education right now. How could it be improved?
I think the competency, it means that it's an outcome. So it's more of an outcome, meaning you are looking that you are competent, like, you know, medical competency, ethics competency, skills competency. And also the culture means that you kind of know that, you know, for this faith, for this social culture, this is what they usually, you know, need, you know, that is how their perspective are. So it is actually kind of an outcome. And I think it can be, you know, going through the theories, you know, reading the humility part is where it's a process where you self-reflect on what you do not know, you know, what are your gaps, and you need to know yourself as well, you know, where are you coming from and why are you thinking in such a way? And even cultures of medicine, even, you know, how does it play into how you are trying to understand your patient? So I think humility part is where it's actually more of that process there. Also trying to say that I'm, you know, humble enough that you know, I want to say that I'm not just a doctor, but I'm trying to help you and trying to fix that power imbalances there. And also in a way, trying to say that we want to partnership with, you know, anyone which advocates for systemic changes, everything. So it's kind of a big, I would say it would be a big training module.
Yeah. And it's a huge, mindset change as well, because we are still used to a very hierarchical and patriarchal approach in healthcare.
Yes.
Dr. Sushila, was there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I guess... Dr. Tan already, you know, touched on it. The fact that it's a very personal thing as well, that, you know, the level of awareness, self-awareness, to be able to reflect and to learn from your different interactions with different people from different cultures and learn from that and to know when you are actually, are we having any form of self-bias, judgment, you know, from our past, from our cultural upbringing, from our family nurturing, you know, be very careful of that, be very aware of that in how, when we are dealing with another person. I think that applies not just in healthcare, but everything we do now when we work with people from different cultures. And yeah, I think that's probably still a budding and a big area that, you know, still developing in many medical education curriculum, probably not needs to be emphasized more for the future. And yeah, maybe across healthcare personnel also, you know, not just for doctors, you know, people mm-hmm. who are attending to people at the counters and all, the very first line, I think that makes the big difference for the first encounter at healthcare.
Very much so, yeah. Dr. Tan, any steps that we can take to begin addressing the socioeconomic determinants that you talked about when that, you know, that determines health, right? It's not about the healthcare system at the secondary, tertiary level, but the their access to just a better quality of life. I mean, it's a huge question, yeah. A huge issue.
So I'm probably not a health policy scientist. And what we can see is actually the two things that they always talk about is making health an agenda in all policies. So meaning, you know, like if you are from another ministry and you always put health agenda there as well. And you when you're talking about education, you think about health. And you know, so that is where they call health in all policies. And that is how we want to fix those social determinants. And indirectly, you know, it will kind of trickle down that you know, citizens or non-citizens to be healthier. And the other way is actually coming from the healthcare systems to work on the social determinants in the healthcare system. So which things that we have just talked about. And, you know, how to navigate, you know, through the social cultural barriers, financing issues, you know. So that is where there are two parts of how you could actually look into working on it. So I would say from the healthcare providers, we say that, you know, keeping the safe space when they come to us, at least try and respect, you know, the person in front of you, you know, trying to understand what they need, what they understand. And, you know, trying to always remember there are many, many layers outside of your clinics and the walls of your clinic that how they come into and why they are refusing care. You know, some of our patients actually refuse surgeries for their children, you know, and in a sense that they know that they are not able to cope outside of after discharge, you know, and it's a very sad thing that we are not able to help. You know, that they have decided to kind of, you know, abort the surgery and, you know, when we feel there was a chance for the child, you know, so I think that part, to be aware of how they came and, you know, kind of understand in that sense. But many of the healthcare providers are very torn every time they were not able to give what they are supposed to give. And also the perception of care is different, you know, depends on where you are coming from. And, you know, that if they think that the standard of care is at that level and you know, healthcare professionals will be putting a different kind of standards in Malaysia, you know. So I think there is always that struggle about knowing, you know, whether you have giving enough. So what we do is, like, if you have a chance for more time of deliberation between your patients, it would be a shared decision making. So meaning you have you try and say that, you know, this is what is needed depending on the conditions that you're having now, and this is what my recommendation. And the patient would definitely fit in to you about their values and preferences, and you know, then we work on what is the best way for everyone. So, yeah.
So would it make a difference if healthcare providers had an ethics, you know, committee or a team that they could reach out to? So when things like this happen, that they can get support to help them put an ethical lens on their decision-making. Do I push my patient? Do I force them to have the surgery? You know, something like that?
So I think that's basically the cases that has been referred to us. You know, and hospital institutional ethics committees or support services are not there. So in Ampang, we are one of the first in the country in a public hospital who have a full-fledged, I would say not only public hospitals, it's all hospitals. So I think we are one of the first of having that services where that healthcare professionals kind of referred cases where they do not know what are the options. Whether the decisions that they've made were ethical. And, you know, we try and analyze, give some clarity. You know, I think the recommendations that we give are usually not binding, but we kind of look into what are the ethically acceptable options that, you know, then we know that there is this constraint, you know, this is the best thing that we could give them. And so I think that is very much needed in Malaysia. And I think that's the reason that clinical ethics is a field that needs to be developed and you know, expand.
All right. Can I get a final message from both of you today? Dr. Sushila, perhaps can start with you.
I think there needs to be a lot more. There needs to be a lot of effort in making this progress in this area, because I think there's so many factors, as we've discussed, whether it's at the individual or systemic or institutional level. There's so much work to do, but I think we can all start with that little openness of the heart, I guess, to allow that, you know, that other person's basic need for healthcare needs to be respected, and how do we go to, you know, allow that to happen for them. If persons are able to be, you know, having that approach at all levels, I think the experience of accessing healthcare may be better for many of these vulnerable populations. But in the end, also, of course, the systemic change needs to be there to be to have that enabling environment, not just for the patients, but also for the healthcare providers to practice ethically and to provide the utmost that they want to do for the patients.
Dr. Tan, final message?
I think we should keep the discourse and, you know, the discussions on at all levels, you know, like what we're having now today. And, you know, just starting to kind of change mindset and, you know, kind of might not really, but grow, you know, have some seeds there and it will grow. And hopefully it will kind of bottom up and, you know, kind of the way that from, you know, small things that we do, and, you know, step by step, and it will kind of make more, you know, persuasion in terms of a higher level and a more systemic level. So it works both. It's either top down or bottom up. And not just one vulnerable group, but many other vulnerable groups.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. We only had the space to really look at refugees and migrant workers today, but so many other people living among us, the urban poor, for instance, people with disabilities, ethnic minorities, face their own challenges as well. Stuff for future discussions, I hope. Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Dr. Sushila Balasundaram, Associate Public Health Officer at UNHCR, and Dr. Tan Hui Siew, Head of Hospital Ethics Support Service at Hospital Ampang and co-founder of the Malaysian Bioethics Community. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.